This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. Much of the organizing against Donald Trump's dangerous agenda is taking place on social media and using internet technology. It's tempting to be enamored of the tools that we have at our disposal to communicate with one another, particularly given how unprecedented this instant communication is. But in reality, the networks we use and rely on are designed by elites and for elites. On a global scale, this is true as well, where the Western English-speaking world dominates the information and communication that's available. Well, rather than equalizing unequal groups, does the internet, as it's designed today, simply reflect or even perpetuate existing inequality? If so, how can we change this design? My guest is Ramesh Srinivasan. He is the director of the Digital Cultures Lab, an associate professor of information studies and design and media arts at the University of California, Los Angeles. And he now joins me to discuss his new book, Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. Welcome to the program, Ramesh.
Oh, I'm honored, Sonali. I'm a big fan of the program. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So before we get into the how can this design be changed aspect of it, let's talk about how the internet today is structured and how it has evolved in a way. I mean, we want to think of it as this great equalizer, and it's true. Anybody can start a website, go online, and broadcast their views, their videos, their writings, etc., to the world. Why then do you see a dominance by elites on both small and macro scales?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely correct. The internet at its birth was always envisioned as a radically grassroots, democratically oriented space and environment because of the potentials for all of us to create and disseminate and distribute information as we saw fit. But what very quickly happened with the internet is an emergence of major corporations that began to become our gatekeepers, if you will, or our pathways to experiencing the larger digital world. So now in the world, we have approximately 4 billion out of the 7 billion people in total in our world have some sort of internet access. And nearly 2 billion, to be precise, 1.8 billion of those users are experiencing the internet, at least in part, through Google or Facebook. So these two small companies, both of which have their home now in Northern California, in a very specific region in the world, are actually constructing the modes by which users all over the world are experiencing the digital world. So what we're actually speaking about is a mechanism by which a couple companies located in very specific parts of the world that have the technical and political elite kind of aspects to them are actually able to essentially shape the larger digital world. And so that is very problematic on lots of different levels.
So it's not that there are obstacles to people creating content. It's how others find that content. And when they have to go through Google's filters or Facebook's filters, they basically can't get any traction unless they are, you know, hooked into a bigger network or basically have a lot of money to throw at marketing or advertising, right?
Sure. So that's right. It's either about how you find information or increasingly how information finds you, right? Mm-hmm. So like when we're on Facebook, the information finds us based on what is or is not visible on our news feeds or on our walls. And those modes by which search results or even personalized information pushed onto you, the modes by which those things are organized, the mechanisms by which those forms of information are structured are all completely opaque to us as users. So we don't know what decisions and transactions are being made around our information that relates us to the information we experience and that we put out there.
Right. And that filtering, which happened, you know, kind of quietly without us really noticing, that's where a lot of this happens. When you read the news today, you wonder, is this news at the top of my feed because it's the most important thing in the world, or because Google or Facebook or whoever thinks that that's what I want to be reading?
Exactly. So that actually legitimates the narrative that we see right now, where Trump is able to exploit people's connections, if not addictions, to social media technologies to actually, in a way, denigrate what news media is. And that's very interesting because we're at a moment where, you know, many of us as scholars and activists have been critical of news media in different ways, and that's a very healthy critique. But now the critiques of news media are being appropriated and taken on by Trump to actually combat the news media. And in so doing, that is actually a mechanism of continuing to privilege what people are already doing, which is experiencing information in these algorithmically curated bubbles.
Now, you cite in your book a really interesting graphic by a man named Tom Goodwin that really caught my attention, pointing out that Uber, the world's largest taxi company, owns no vehicles. Facebook, the world's most popular media owner, creates no content. Alibaba, the most valuable retailer, has no inventory, and Airbnb, the world's largest accommodation provider, owns no real estate. What does this pattern tell us about how these companies have managed to reshape not just the internet, but our economy?
Yes, absolutely. Massive amounts of wealth are being accumulated by these types of platforms, which are essentially infrastructures to connect entities with other entities without owning almost anything, and more importantly, without really employing any substantial amounts of labor. Certainly not labor in a traditional sense, which is benefits-based, living wage-based. It's very contract-based, flexible, fluid, and fragmented. Micro labor is what's happening here. And so that gives rise to incredibly problematic dynamics where we see massive amounts of economic stratification starting to occur, which we see with gentrification and so on. Instagram was sold for a couple billion dollars with 14 employees to Facebook the same month, or within a couple months at most, that Kodak, with tens of thousands of employees, went bankrupt. So this is part of what we see occurring. Sharing economy is sort of a misnomer. It's a mechanism by which we think of the fluidity by which we are experiencing different forms of information, but it all has to go through these platforms which monetize the transactions.
Let's talk about what you found about how particularly marginalized communities experience the internet today, from Indian reservations here in the United States to India. Tell us about your travels and what you found about this buzz phrase that we think of, the digital divide. As you mentioned, 4 billion people today are on the internet. Mark Zuckerberg would view this through a completely different lens than you did.
Sure. Absolutely. I travel to different parts of the world and work with various communities, diverse user communities, basically people from different cultures and different places, including activists who are new users of technology. And my interest is in thinking about how their voices, their notions of agency, their practices can be empowered through how we rethink technology together. So what I see in all of my projects around the world is that there is incredibly powerful possibilities for communities to come together with designers or engineers and develop alternative ways in which technologies can support their communities. So for example, in southern India, where I was living off and on for 3 years, these communities didn't have a very strong level of textual literacy. And as a result, there were some elements of fatalism as these communities were deciding what to do, because so many people from those communities were migrating to the cities. That's a big dynamic in many parts of the world, especially in places like India. So what we looked at is what happens when we use technology to empower local storytelling, so people across those communities can reflect on who they are, have new types of conversations, and then collectively mobilize for their own futures, their own visions of development. Similarly, the book features lots of stories of me basically hanging out with Native American communities and learning profound amounts of information from them that have really shaped my life in so many ways. I learned how Native American cultures, and there's no single culture, the diversity of cultures, how Native American ways of knowing, Native American traditions could actually be refracted onto how we design and think about technology. In other words, thinking about technology as a conduit to support traditional ways of knowing, rather than technology as a way to take all of us in all our diverse experiences and force us into the logic that drives systems like Google and Facebook.
And so wouldn't that be culture specific then, that each sort of traditional way of documentation that exists in cultures and finding ways to reflect that on the internet, it seems as though it would be sort of a gargantuan task and also a very, specific, community-specific task.
Sure. There is a level of specificity in the collaborations that these projects represent, but they all also represent a larger theme, which is far more scalable, which is what happens when technology platforms are opened up to increasingly larger amounts of autonomy and self-determination for diverse user communities. So it doesn't have to be me that's as a cultural studies scholar or as a media design person going to those communities and developing all of this together. It's more about what happens when Facebook starts to open up the ways in which its different user communities can actually start to organize information in and of themselves and make choices around who they want to share information to and who they don't on what terms. So it's actually about it's about opening up the black boxes that have given rise to these terms that we hear today, especially with Trump as president, echo chambers, filter bubbles. It's about opening those platforms up so that local communities can articulate their own visions and their own voices on top of those platforms. And so that's a big part of the theme of the book. The book is saying it's high time for these companies with, you know, multi-billions of users to recognize that they aren't simply a for-profit company. They are actually the public face and, in fact, the global face of communication and, in this case, journalism and news in the United States, with 70% of American adults accessing their news through Facebook.
Yeah. So how does something like Facebook or even Google reinforce and even exacerbate existing inequality, racial inequality, class inequality, historical colonial structures and dynamics? I mean, can you give us an example?
Absolutely. So first and foremost, there's some fascinating studies that show that if I'm wealthy and you're poor, or you're wealthy and I'm poor, and we're provided the exact same technology access, and we both know exactly what to do with that technology access, you are going to disproportionately benefit because you're already wealthy than me as the poorer person, because you already have the resources in your world that you can activate through the uses of technology. So this digital divide is reinforced. It's exacerbated through access. But in the context of these platforms like Google and Facebook, which offer a range of different types of services, it's really, really important to recognize what are the biases, unintentional or not, that are built into these platforms. So, for example, I have colleagues like at Microsoft even, and scholars who are looking at how various AI algorithms, like artificial intelligence algorithms being put out, actually reconfirm kind of white male biases around what a face should look like, or even what certain types of digital behavior might look like. So the point is that often as designers, we think we're creating neutral tools and technologies, but we always create scientific and technological devices and systems in our own image as people, but also in our own image as a culture of designers, as a culture of a part of the world. So in this manner, there are these forms of stratification that are unintentionally occurring. I'll give you a very simple example. In a piece that's going to be coming out on Quartz in the next 2 weeks, I was interested in the West African country of Cameroon. I did a search on the country of Cameroon, and my top websites, a Google search, mm-hmm. yes. And the top websites I saw about Cameroon were not written from Cameroon at all. And one of them was the CIA World Factbook website, right? And so that's not saying that the CIA World Factbook is incorrect as a representation of Cameroon, but it also says that people from Cameroon, insofar as they create websites, are not given the power to articulate even themselves in relation to my search results, right? And so this is an interesting point. What counts as knowledge through Google searches has everything to do with what is found and the ordering, the ranking of what you see. And who is fit to speak about themselves in a world? Is it those of us who represent the other, or is it other people directly on their own?
So what are the ways in which communities are able to reshape the internet? I mean, you know, we could certainly all petition Mark Zuckerberg to either explain how the filters work or do away with them altogether and just go to a straight news feed. as it used to be once upon a time. Google's filters are a whole nother issue. And also, we should remind ourselves that a lot of these filters are determined by marketing, by ads, because to Google and Facebook, we are not consumers of information. We are consumers of products, and we are there to simply spend money and make money for them.
And our information is the oil of the digital economy, right? It's our information is what is monetizable because it can be tracked and aggregated and analyzed, so it can so it can facilitate the consumption of various types of products. Absolutely, absolutely.
And so what are the ways, short of demanding that Facebook restructure itself, what are ways that people can, there's a lot of discussion for creating alternative online platforms, and it's really difficult. I mean, you know, when you're really used to using Facebook and your entire community and network is on Facebook, to say, well, here's another platform that you should migrate to, most people aren't going to do it.
Right. And there was that whole experiment with Elo that was exciting for people at the beginning, but it kind of plateaued quickly. No, absolutely. I think there's a few things. First of all, as users, we have to have some more kind of technological / political literacy about what is happening with our data and where it's going. And therefore, when we use different platforms, we need to have some sort of mindfulness and awareness of where that data might go and what parts of ourself we want to choose to present on what platforms. So that's first. Second, the book, Who's Global Village, my book that's just come out, is all about showing some community-based alternatives where the communities I work with, Native American communities, indigenous peoples in the Oaxaca region in Mexico, I tell stories of activists in Tahrir Square that I worked with off and on for 3 years. This book is full of stories of how these communities are analyzing their existing world, and they're either building and assembling different kinds of technology networks, some of which are using Facebook, some of which might be totally offline, and they're actually organizing a network structure to support their own communities. And so part of that is realizing the limitations of these tools and how these tools might connect with other tools. Like, for example, in Egypt, they were using new media and social media tools like Twitter, not to reach the vast majority of the population that didn't have this access nor was interested, but to actually transform satellite television and to actually change the ways the TV narratives, which were much more accessible in Egypt, were made for people. So I basically think that the most important thing here is on an individual level, there needs to be kind of a form of political and technological literacy, including issues of surveillance and privacy. And there's some good work done out there that needs to get further out. But I think on the level of culture and user communities and political communities, we really need to develop and share projects that are inspiring and that have achieved some successes, where we look at how those communities have mindfully and strategically used those different platforms in different ways, in ways that you never would have anticipated, and in so doing, shaped their movement and their culture in that way. So like one example I talk about very briefly in the book, and it's what I'm working on right now, is a project where all these indigenous peoples all around the Oaxaca region of Mexico, they've literally built their own cell phone networks.
Wow.
it's so amazing. It's like the coolest thing ever. And the reason why they've done that is because they were getting exploited by the telecom companies. They're being charged exorbitant rates because the telecom companies didn't see them as worth their investment because there's not enough of them. They live in cloud forest areas, and they're not wealthy enough. So these people said, we're just going to set up our own networks, a collectively owned network, right? Like, so all our models around who owns technology, who owns data, how that technology network is set up and designed, all of that is localized.
And of course, when you have everybody relying on one particular platform, say Facebook, and using it for everything, it becomes very easy for dictators to simply switch off that one platform. You give all your power over, to someone who, with a switch of a button, can, or a metaphorical switch of the button, can cut off your access to communication.
Right. And so that actually is interesting. When Mubarak in 2011 in Egypt, in relation to Tahrir Square, hit the kill switch, is what they call it, in relation to mobile telephony and internet access, that was actually the day of largest, the largest physical mobilization right. occurred right at that time. Partly because people no longer could turn to their devices to experience and interact with information from an ongoing revolution, they had to get onto the streets. So it's really, really interesting. It's like a hydra, right? Like you cut off one head of a movement, others can grow. Only if that movement is determined to grow and is aware of its adversaries and knows that it can achieve a victory. And I see those kinds of examples at play, not just with the examples I describe in my book, but also with issues like the Black Lives Matter movement. To some extent, though, I'm concerned with the Dakota Pipeline movement, with immigration movements right now in the United States, and definitely with Occupy when that was occurring as well.
My guest is Ramesh Srinivasan. He is the director of the Digital Cultures Lab and associate professor of information studies and design and media arts at UCLA. We're talking about his book, Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. We're going to keep him on for an extended conversation, which you can access on the premium content section of our website at risingupwithsonali.com. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can also find us on Twitter at twitter.com/ruwithsonali. So Ramesh, let's continue our conversation about movements today, particularly as they struggle with the issue of surveillance, which you touched upon earlier. Under President Obama, we saw a great expansion of the architecture of surveillance, which Absolutely. Now with Trump is a very, very frightening prospect indeed. But the more we use digital platforms, the more vulnerable we remain to spying by the NSA. And then with someone like Trump at the helm, the potential for abuse is even greater. How do we deal with that?
It's a very distressing situation. There's no question about it. I think on some level, we need to be aware of all the different ways, and you won't believe how many, that uses of platforms like Google and Facebook can provide various forms of supposedly incriminating information that could be used, right? And there are a number of things that folks don't know. Like, for example, even if their phone is on airplane mode, information can be gathered about them as soon as it goes off of that mode, or that the microphones on our laptops and the cameras on our computers all could be input devices, even if they're not actively being used by us. So that, of course, does lend itself to some fear and at times even hysteria.
Particularly for marginalized communities, you know,
right.
Black sure. communities in the U.S. know that they were the biggest targets of COINTELPRO.
No doubt. And I think on some level, the best thing that we can do is to be aware and work with groups like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and actually learn about what are the different kinds of devices and systems that are safe to use in what contexts. However, I do think on some level, the movements themselves need to think about ways in which they might invert the game, shift to the game, to actually start to whistleblow and document the abuses around surveillance and civil rights that might be coming from the state or the apparatuses of the state, from the police, for example, and use these same digital tools to actually push those kinds of groups to actually increase the public outcry in relation to those groups. But one of the most powerful dynamics that I observed in my time in Egypt, and I wrote a few pieces about this in Al Jazeera at that time, and also it's in the book, the Whose Global Village book that's just come out, is really about how these communities, on some level, they realized, these activist communities realized that what they needed to do was broaden their message across lots of different platforms. And so they didn't necessarily bow solely to the temple of new technology. They realized that they had to take things into analog spaces, if you will.
So diversifying their communication platforms, basically.
That's precisely what I'm saying. They diversified their platforms. They organized in lots of different ways. They took petitions that were on Twitter and then turned them into photocopying paper petitions that were signed by 35 million people in
Wow.
June of 2013. They took content that was documented for social documentation purposes on YouTube, and they transferred it into video cassettes that were floating all over the country that were being projected onto public spaces like Tahrir Square, but also all over the country. So they quickly realized that they could build networks, they could build activist networks, they could build oppositional networks that opposed the state without having to have those networks be built on some sort of opaque and invisible proprietary technology that could easily be surveyed.
So knowing the limitations of existing platforms is really important, using them to the extent they can be used, but then also adding many other ways of communicating if those platforms are compromised. Sounds like one way to sort of approach the internet. I mean, you know, one might imagine that particularly indigenous communities, for non-indigenous people, people might have the wrong impression that there is a Luddite streak that runs through some of these communities. Sure. But in fact, it's not true. Digital communication is a very powerful tool. If it's good enough for, you know, industrialized communities and urban centers, it's good enough for those folks who are struggling in spaces that are far flung, right?
Absolutely. Winona LaDuke, a major Native American leader who's been active at Standing Rock, endorsed my book and the Who's Global Village book and has written a comment. And she talked about the power of video streaming and documentation for Indigenous peoples to not only document their claims, but to document abuses and to actually share their incredibly rich connections to issues like Standing Rock. And I believe what happens if you kind of simply take the digital world in this kind of flat and naive way is we dumb down the narratives around why people choose to act the way they do. So, like, for example, at Standing Rock, many of the Standing Rock Sioux explain the reason they're trying to protect this water is not even for them, it's for seven generations after them, right? And that's really interesting. That part of the narrative is generally absent when we look on our random Facebook pages, or even when we look at news media reporting, like mainstream news media reporting on the topic.
Right, so because mainstream news media don't understand the context of that idea of seven generations.
It's cosmological, it's spiritual, it's affective, it's community-based, it's performative, it's powerful. It's really powerful. And so I really believe that we are right now at a moment where a very limited number of forces that are unfortunately increasingly working with systems of policing and surveillance are dominating our experiences of the internet. And, you know, it is not okay to say that Facebook is simply a for-profit company that should be has a competitive product to compete with other people. It is the public face of journalism in the United States. And all journalism, like all media, is subject and must be subject to some public scrutiny and at times public regulation. And, you know, that's the story at the end of the day. Their emergence, their success, so to speak, their scale is actually now reasons why we have to ask questions of them and actually ask them to be more socially responsible.
Well, Ramesh, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with your book. Is there, aside from people finding it in bookstores, is there a website that you'd like to share?
Yes, absolutely. So the book is called Who's Global Village? And then kind of question mark at the end. It has a really cool cover. I think everyone will like it for the cover, at least the cover. And it's on Amazon. It's also on the NYU Press website. And I'm going to be doing quite a few pieces over the next couple of weeks with CNN, with Quartz, with KCRW, some different networks to share these stories, possibly MSNBC. So I'm really excited to share this with all of you. We also are going to be doing some in-store events. We're going to do an event at Skylight Books on March 4th at 5 p.m. And if you connect with me on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is Ramesh, R-A-M-E-S-H, Media, M-E-D-I-A, I can also let you know about our further events. We'll probably do one in April at the Last Bookstore here in Los Angeles.
Thanks so much again, Ramesh. Good luck to you.
Oh, my pleasure. The pleasure is all mine. I love your show. So thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. My guest is Ramesh Srinivasan. He is the director of the Digital Cultures Lab and associate professor of information studies and design and media arts at UCLA. We're talking about his book, Who's Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Twitter at twitter.com/ruwithsonali.